Hello, you're listening to the Gambling Files podcast. We're brought to you by those fine people, those recruitment experts, gamingrecruitmentsolutions.com. No.
GRS-hyphen.
Well, you did GRS. Say press record and see what can go wrong. And we've just found out almost immediately. GRS-recruit.com.
Sorry, Paul.
You can't apologize when you just let me do it. My God, did you not do your due diligence?
I can't control what comes out of your mouth. It's out of my control.
People have tried in the
You're
past.
You're a maverick, John. You're a maverick. Nobody can control you.
I'm a wild man. I'm a classic lone wolf.
It's with the lone wolf jumper on and everything, howling at the moon.
It's what's
a
surprising.
QVC classic seller. It was one of the best episodes I ever saw of The Apprentice. I've only watched two. One of them I didn't like. One episode I liked was they dropped the apprentices into the QVC studios. Uh-huh. And the guys had to do, like, they'd an hour of programming to plan. Right? So they had to pick the products.
Jesus.
And then do the programming for an hour, whatever the session was, right? And so the guys come in and they go through all the stuff and they pick something and they run with it and it's a complete flop. Right. And then they're doing the debrief afterwards with like one of the QVC managers and he holds up like this jumper and it's your like the wolf howling at the moon. Now, and
I know the one.
The woods in the background and that whole shebang. He said, you should have picked something. You guys picked something you liked. You didn't pick stuff our audience likes. You should have done this instead. And he holds up the thing. And I just thought that was a great, just a great lesson. It was just brilliant. Like, it's not about you and what you like. It's about what the customer likes. And some of your customers like the wolf jumper.
It's
always
very,
stuck
very
with me
fair.
For some reason. I don't know why.
It's very, very fair. I mean, when I was working there, you know, the schedulers had an incredibly difficult job because they have to make X amount of money for every second they're on air. Mm. And so it's timetabled rigorously. There's this three-way conversation between presenter, producer, and scheduler, and it's about stock levels. It's about constant feed of information. I mean, it's brutal. It's really, really hard. And I'm not overstating that. It's really, really tough.
I'd believe it. Yeah, I'd believe it.
God, it's a weird memory. I there was a chap I knew who somebody I knew at QVC was asking me if I knew anybody that could do any tech presenting for them, and I thought there was a guy I knew who was had a lot of sort of mainstream TV experience, and I'd been sort of kind of working under him at this publishing company in Exeter, and I just thought I'd put him in touch with them. I didn't especially like the guy. I didn't dislike him, but he was, you know, I didn't really know him particularly. And he went and he did a load of presenting for them. And he said to me a couple of years later, oh, thanks for that. It actually paid for my wedding. So I'm like, great. I actually went to work for him not that long after that. And I edited a magazine for him. And I was probably maintaining a period of burnout, which was quite interesting. And it was a really, really difficult job. It was a big magazine, high pagination, 13 issues a year, 164 pages an issue. You know, it's really, really hard.
Jesus Christ, that's huge.
And a really inexperienced team. It wasn't my favorite experience. It was slightly crushing. And I left after a while anyway. And I applied for a job. I must have told you this before. I applied for a job at a publishing company in Bath.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned this one.
And it was just like, you know, it was a woodworking magazine and I just needed some work. I didn't have anywhere to live, etc. And this guy kindly refused to give me a reference. No, sorry, I tell a lie. This guy should have refused to give me a reference. What this guy actually did was I had one glowing reference from a former employer and I had this guy who I had said to him, is that okay if I put you down as a reference? Yeah, of course it is. And he then said to them, off the record, John's like this, this, and this, right? Mm. Now, that's not always a negative because this, 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 and this might be exactly what you're looking for, which was how I ended up on Casino International. But to me, as a person who was technically without a home, needed some work, perfectly capable of doing the job and perfectly personable when I'm in the office. It smacked of somebody just being really, really unpleasant because they could be, and because they thought it would never, ever come back on them. Now, it's a small world. And at some point, we're going to bump into each other again.
Yeah. It's
and the amount of stuff that he stole when we were on that magazine, you wouldn't believe. But anyway, that's by the by. Let's just say that no competition winners ever got their prizes. Not one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's the kind of asshole I'm talking about. So what was the URL?
GRS-recruit.com, gaming recruitment solutions. Paul and the guys, brilliant team, all your recruitment needs, big jobs, little jobs, lots of jobs, whatever you're hiring for, or if you're looking for a job. You know, it's that kind of year. You know, it's May, it's probably bonus season, maybe it didn't quite go as well as you expected. It's time to maybe have a chat.
Do you feel like you're more favorable to GRS-recruit.com after having a steak with Paul?
I think it's always the same, right? It's you know, we live in such a world where everything we do is online and digital and virtual and stuff. Like, if you think of it, like, we've met once for 10 minutes, right? It's ridiculous, right? So it's always, if you can, I think there's a real psychological thing that if you can sit down with somebody and have a conversation and have a steak and have a chat and just, you know, that kind of just, it's an easy conversation. It doesn't, you know what it's like. It's somebody you get on with, there's an easy conversation. The conversation just flows and it's really enjoyable. And you're like, oh, that was really nice. That was really nice.
I can certainly imagine what that would be like. Yes.
So you don't get that on online, because when you're dealing with people online, it's typically like, right, business, stuff like that. So it's really like, I think one of the difficulties for like a working from home for a lot of companies is you miss the small talk and the social signals of just like, oh, he looks like he's in a bad mood, or she looks tired, or they're upbeat and a bit of chit chat and, you know, just a bit of whatever. You lose all that and it becomes very kind of to-do list focused type stuff, which I think unless your team know each other already, you kind of lose that social cohesion, probably for want of a better word. Anyway, look, sitting down, having lunch with somebody or a dinner with somebody or something like that, even a coffee, I think is actually we're social creatures. And I think, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Maybe that's where we went wrong, because we never sat down. We walked.
We did. We power walked through the exit to go get a taxi. Well, in my defense, you told me you weren't going. And so I'd scheduled my week. And then it turns out you were there. And tough shit. That was basically...
Well, you know, your diary fills up quickly because...
I was getting meeting requests for ICE in early December.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. That's
well, I still had a regular paycheck in early December, so I wasn't that worried. Good times.
Happy days.
So last week we had the first two events on the game.
How did it go?
Mixed bag, I would say.
Okay.
So the RG event was Wednesday, Thursday. And that was kind of... I wasn't looking at how many people were watching. I knew that my focus had to be on, let's just make this really good. Right.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so it was really good. We had one session didn't record, unfortunately. Okay. And that was the first one with the shadow gambling minister, which is a shame because she was absolutely terrific. But all of the other ones will be archived and hosted. They're hosted at the moment or using Zoom's cloud, but we're going to move them off that so that they're available for much longer. And we'll find ways to sort of publish extracts and bits and bobs. But the people were just fabulous. Mm. Really, really fabulous. So the opening one was Ethics. Then we did Women as Problem Gamblers. We had a lady called Lisa Edwards on that from Bet No More, talking about her experience. And that was, whew, crikey. But she's now, you know, helping people in her situation, which is pretty amazing. And we had Harp Edwards. Do you remember Harp from Gordon Moody?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah, we had Harp on, and she was fabulous. I mean, she's in such a unique place. And it was just that whole thing was phenomenal. And we had a lady called Judy Treblecock, who is the Brunel University. She's a criminologist. And she was talking about her experience of interviewing women who have ended up in jail as a result of gambling issues. Okay. So we just had – everything was just kind of – I tried to just find people from different backgrounds. And people pop up. Like Julie was a last-minute addition. She was fantastic. She was really brilliant. Stuff like that. And Michael and Dr. Michael Auer, friend of the podcast, and Professor Mark Griffiths, or Dr. Mark Griffiths, professor of from Nottingham Trent University, they presented some of their papers and talked about those. And we had there was a chat about RG as a branding problem, stuff like that. And it was all genuinely, it was all really, really good. And I'm really, really pleased with it.
So if I'm listening to the podcast right now and I'm like, oh, I'd like to listen to some of that, where would I go, John?
Well, that's a great question, Fintan, and I'm glad you asked. You can go to www.thegamingboardroom.com, and it will hopefully be hosted on there by now for you to have a little watch or a listen. I'm thinking about stripping the audio out and doing some audio only, hosting some audio only versions so people can download and listen like it's a podcast.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. You know, part of the beauty of doing something like this from scratch is we can do things and just see how people want to digest them. That's really interesting. But the second,
there'll definitely be. It's one of those people will want different. Different people want different things.
Yeah, totally.
So anyway, I'm sorry. Finding out what they second want. Event.
Well, that was Friday, and that went wrong, unfortunately. Again, the content terrific. Can't fault it. So Melanie Ellis, friend of the podcast, and I were discussing the UK gambling white paper. We broke it into two sessions. We were going to do three sessions, but Michael disappeared, former friend of the podcast. So I had to cancel the RG session just because he'd spent 2 days with me on the RG thing and basically had a load of business stuff to do.
He just had enough. Yeah.
I think maybe he'd seen too much of me. Yeah. I'm a classic lone wolf, Fintan. He was just fed up seeing me lick my balls. And because if you're a lone wolf, you've got to lick your own. Do you know what I mean?
That's a good point.
So we had a 10:30 session, which was about the impact of online, 1:30 session, which was the impact on land-based, not just casinos, but land-based gambling. And it was great, but the stream to LinkedIn didn't work because we're doing it on our events platform and pushing it out to LinkedIn Live. And the two things weren't talking, and I could not fucking get them to talk. And so because it was being recorded, we were just like, okay, fine. We'll just figure out what's going wrong and we'll push the recording out. Be fine. We couldn't get it to work for the second session either, which was really, it was pretty annoying because people were waiting on LinkedIn for it.
Oh, no.
And, you know, it's your first, it's essentially your first week of doing events. So it was like, oh, for fuck's sake. It was frustrating. I mean, as far as I'm aware, it's nobody's fault. I'm going to be asking the event provider, you know, the event platform provider about it. Hopefully they can give me some answers so we can avoid it in future. And if they can't, then we're going to switch platforms. But do you know what? The main reason it was annoying is because Melanie did a fantastic presentation. She did two fantastic presentations.
But it is recorded.
It is. They're both recorded. I put the links
for
the...
You could put it up on LinkedIn.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's probably about an hour for each one. So video-wise, I don't know if you could put the whole video on LinkedIn, but we can slice it up. Yeah,
probably. Or just link
to
it.
Or we can host it elsewhere. Yeah, host it elsewhere, embed it. We can do whatever we want with it. Because the idea with that one was to just get it out to as many people as we can. So I'll be working on pushing that out this week. Yeah.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
But it was just cool. Annoying. You know, when you see somebody's done great work and Melanie's brilliant and the, you know, Northridge seemed really sound, and it was just disappointing that we couldn't just shout that out, sort of thing. But you know, you live, you learn, and we will spread their word far and wide next week and see what happens.
Nice. So who do we have on the podcast this week?
It's a great question, Fintan. We've got from the gambling world's number one cabal, Ishmael Vali, founder and CEO of YieldSec, also known as The Syndicate. I feel like I should do a little Dr. Evil around my...
So what did we talk? We talked to Ishmael about his company, his product, how he can measure channelization, monitor it, what it means, estimates. He's actually got estimates for, say, channelization in the UK market, which I think was a super interesting one. And he's had a fascinating journey as well. So he's a super interesting guy, super passionate about what he does. And yeah, it's definitely worth a listen.
But I got to say, while his Kevin Costner film might have been predictable, his Michael Douglas one was not.
From left field, that was.
That was actually from right field, I think.
Or whatever you want to say it, but it wasn't Wall Street, which...
Well, it was a movie that was criticized very much when it came out, in the same way as Year of the Dragon was about 4 years previously to it, for not sort of racist attitudes, but it was quite heavily criticized. Not as much as Year of the Dragon, because Year of the Dragon wasn't hiding where its heart lay, I should say. But no, it was an interesting one. And as for Wall Street, tell you what, right? My granddad got married to who my mother referred to as his special lady friend, which I still find a hilarious phrase to this day. He married a lovely lady called Betty who was way too good for him. And they got married in, must have been 1987, I guess. And I said to my mum, I said, look, you know, I'm sure the reception is going to be great and everything, but everybody there is going to be really, really old and it's in the middle of the day and there's a cinema just down the road. So I'm going to duck out to the cinema. So for my granddad's wedding reception, I actually went to watch Wall Street at the cinema.
Brilliant.
And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I haven't seen the sequel.
Shit. Sequel shit. The actual sequel to Wall Street is The Wolf of Wall Street. That's a much better sequel to it.
Do you know, I've not seen The Wolf of Wall Street. I haven't watched much Scorsese. Well, I haven't watched any Scorsese since probably Goodfellas.
It's I think the Wolf of Wall Street's the spiritual sequel.
Maybe we would tell more about people if we asked them what their favorite Scorsese film was. I'm sure a lot of people in the gambling industry would say Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
Slightly older people.
See, no, I'd.
My sort of age.
Obviously would be the other one, right?
No, I think Goodfellas would be the other one.
Mm.
But that's my favourite Scorsese film is from Out of Left Field, and it's one that not that many people even seem to remember. In fact, I've got two. I think King of Comedy is incredibly good. The one after King of Comedy, I think After Hours, I think's absolutely phenomenal.
I'll have to add them to the list.
Don't do it, Fintan. You know it's not worth it. So Ishmael Vali is coming right up. Fintan and myself wish you a blessed day. Enjoy the episode.
Bye. Enjoy the episode. I mean, don't go. Bye. No. Episode.
Stay. We meet our first guest, our only guest, obviously. I've got to break myself out of doing that. It's conditioning, that is, Fintan. It's conditioning. You've brainwashed me. You evil, evil bastard. Just another example of the evil of the gambling industry is you brainwashing me.
It's not even the worst thing I've been called today, mate. So I'm not even bothered.
I'm just delighted you found my brain. Very pleased. And I'm going to invite all of my old secondary school teachers and sixth form tutors to listen to this. Fuck you all. We're joined today by Ismail Vali, founder and CEO of YieldSec. Now, Ismail, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Can I just say yield, I got that right, didn't I? YieldSec.
Yes. It's short for yield security.
YieldSec, it sort of sounds like, you know when you see a really shitty action film and there's this supposed cabal formed of like former government employees who are assassinating people in developing economies for some bizarre government purpose. And they're or there's like a cabal of secret bankers or something. And they're called something really shit, like the Institute.
Yes. And
even in perfectly reputable films, they come up with these tropes and it's just shite. They're always called something like the Institute. They're not called something like the Giant Bastards.
Yeah, so Mission Impossible, Impossible has the Syndicate, doesn't it? Which is quite close to that.
That's the other classic one. The Syndicate or the Institute. It's always one of those. In fact, you know what? The Syndicate is probably even more common. Yeah. But what I'm going to do is, got a few friends who are writers. I'm going to say to them, from now on, YieldSec.
Well, there is a plan there, and I think the cabal would be basically trying to make this gambling machine and the gambling business work for legal kind of stakeholders only. So I'd looked at this after 20 years in operations and just went, we have a looming shadow of kind of crime involved in the business. The crime's always involved in the gambling business because they want to use it for money laundering. The biggest problem we have is that going into regulated marketplace after marketplace, we've got those in America, we've got those in Europe, we've got those in Africa and Latin America now. Those economies are basically looking at gaining the control of gambling because they want the taxation ultimately. And then they want player protection, they want responsible gaming for the audience, etc. And the problem is we've got some people who choose to go onshore, get a license, and many who stay outside the jurisdiction and still continue making money. That has to come to an end if we want sustainable gambling ecosystems, and we don't have anything like that right now.
So how does your system, or probably a quick overview of what it is that YieldSec does will be super useful. Let me kind of start from there.
Well, we're a cabal of like-minded people.
So basically, I looked at what would be capable of looking at a marketplace and understanding that here's the money that comes from the legal operators and here's the business activity that's going on with illegal operators. Now, I went all around different accounting software platforms, different surveillance platforms, and the only thing I found that could work was an anti-terror platform that basically looked at things like beheading videos, so the stuff that Al-Qaeda and ISIS were putting up. That content, as soon as it went online, people were able to find it, they were able to identify it, they were able to flag it, tag it, and get Facebook, Google, whoever it was to remove it pretty quickly. So I looked at the company that had built that software, had a discussion with them around licensing their software for consumer applications, and we came up with our first test platform within about 3 months. So I drew a line between counterinsurgency for ideology and audience and what they were looking at in terrorism content, and what we were looking at with black markets was exactly the same kind of thing, that you're looking for something that reaches a mass audience, you're looking for something that is able to replicate itself across many different source websites, find that content, tag it, and get it removed very quickly. So that's what I did, is basically say a counterinsurgency is basically the same as a commercial insurgency with the black market. The one's looking for ideology and hearts and minds, and the other one's looking for a massive audience, and its ideology is basically just wants to make as much money as possible very quickly.
Sure.
So what's your... Go on.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to ask. So the system then is it's like a, to simplify things, like a web crawler, or so it's crawling the web looking for this content, or how does that work?
And it's most simple, yes, but it works on basically many different methodologies. So it basically looks for a bunch of keywords, looks for a bunch of pay-per-click auctions that are going on. It looks at all the activity online and finds betting, gaming, and lottery keywords effectively. So we're looking
Is it search it's looking at? Is it looking at social media?
All of those.
Telegram groups.
Yeah, looks at search, social media, Discord, and Telegraph groups. It looks at anything it can find openly and publicly. So as long as it's public-facing content, and again, with the nature of online gaming, it wants to look for an audience, so it tends to be advertising.
Yeah.
doesn't tend to be too hidden. And even where it has been hidden, even where we found Discord groups that are behind a kind of paywall or behind a password wall, we're able to find that because the people inside those groups post content elsewhere too. So we find that sure. we find a mirror of something everywhere. So once we're able to find the sites, the advertising, the social media, the influencers and discussion groups, even WhatsApp groups that we don't have open access to, even that stuff gets replicated elsewhere. So we found that the discussion here is basically meant to be monetizable conversations. So all of that stuff ends up being public facing. We can find it. We pay for access to the platforms for our kind of data, people like Facebook and Google. So we're not just kind of going in and crawling the web and looking for stuff and scraping content. We wanted to make sure that we had access to it so we don't breach any data protection rules.
Sure.
And also we're looking at everything from above in that I'm not looking for you, John, and what you've posted. I'm looking for the meta level of there are many Johns who are looking for online gaming content. And I'm going out and finding that stuff.
Got it. Okay. So you go out, you find everything that's publicly available that you can get your hands on or it's been replicated elsewhere. You pull it all together. That first of all, that must just be a huge amount of data.
Huge task, yeah. When we go from, we start out with around 8.5 million different keywords in any marketplace, okay, across betting, gaming, and lottery. Within a few hours on a tech stack that's basically machine learning and AI driven and has a bunch of expert humans involved as well by language, mm-hmm. that thing spawns to kind of around 50 million keywords within about 55 minutes. We get to the point where it's enormous. From there, it continues to kind of look along for team names, team matchups. Then it's looking for product names. Then it's looking for bet types. Then it's looking for bet levels, who's won, who's lost, and all of the conversations that are going on around those. So we find very quickly that it's a very seasonal curve. It goes in line with the sports calendar generally is what tends to drive a lot of the volume. But we find that it is extremely capable of finding that content, allowing us to then bring it into our data warehouse and then crunch that down to, okay, how much activity was there by unique human beings? Of that activity, how much of it was monetizable in that it's not just people hitting the website and then dumping out because it was a pop-up behind a piece of illegal content, for example. So we work out on the algorithms from a case of this is some the dwell time is very important. So how much time did they spend on that web page? Is it looking at opening an account? Is it looking at bet placing content? And what we do to work out the estimates from this is what the legal business is making, this is what the illegal business is making, we work it out to a value per visit. So I wanted to get to a point where it's an apples and apples comparison between this is the legal market, this is the illegal industry. How much money are they making?
Okay, so two questions. So you talked about things like measuring dwell time. How would you measure dwell time? Like in terms of, like I understand what dwell time is, but I mean, how would you physically get access to that data?
So we're able to, because again, we see things from above again. So we take a group of people who are on an illegal website. We're able to say this 30% of that audience basically hit the webpage, dumped out. 20% of the audience hit the webpage and they were there for 7 minutes, which equates to the average registration time, for example.
Are you estimating that or are you using
so we actually buy that data, so we're able to say that from people like Facebook and Google. We're able to get the dwell time on it and on any page on any website basically
from Facebook and Google or from like VPNs and these kind of guys who sell this kind of user data,
also those guys
or
too.
ISPs
yeah exactly
or ISPs and stuff as well. So this is like how SimilarWeb gets a lot of its insights and stuff, right?
So wherever it is that we're buying it from, and there are many different sources for that, we're able to work out that this is how much time is spent on the web pages. This is how we put together an estimate of this is how many people were buying, how many people were browsing, how many people were just bumping back from the website.
Sure. So like if they're on, I don't know, the Pirate Bay and they get a pop under for an online casino, they haven't actually visited that online casino. It's just a pop under and stuff like that. Okay. I understand that. So if we kind of walk through the process, so you've gone out, you've gathered all the data, you've processed all the data, you've layered in user data on top of that to make sense of it and kind of get this apples to apples comparison. And then you've got kind of like you have this apples to apples comparison because obviously you've got the legal data from say, publicly listed companies. Yeah. Regulators and publicly listed companies will publish their data so you can estimate roughly what a customer's worth in each market and these kind of things. What's the end result? Like, what's the end result then? So if you look at a particular market, I was watching an interview with you a few weeks ago, and you were talking about the UK and stuff, which I thought was a great example. And can you kind of just walk through kind of what you guys found?
So basically, we look at the marketplace generally. We tend to look at, there's a big piece there, which is channelization. So what's the total addressable marketplace? Mm-hmm. So I want to get to a point of, we think the marketplace in the UK is worth $6 billion a year. The marketplace is actually worth X billion a year, because you have to factor in all that illegal business too. So you're then looking at what are the customers interacting with. So in a marketplace like the UK, you've had legal gambling online and offline for as long as we all can remember, okay? So if the customers there are looking for stuff, what is it that they're in particular looking for? So because we never had any of that prohibition period in the UK, there isn't that residual self-memory of, well, there's sites that are illegal that I continue going to because they've always been there and they're fairer for me as a customer quite often. So there's none of that kind of stuff in the UK. We've got 2,500 licensed website destinations in the United Kingdom. What customers are looking for in the United Kingdom is, if I've self-excluded and I'm on GamStop, I can't participate with any of those legal sites. So that's created this kind of vacuum where regulation has said, we have vulnerable audiences and we want to put them behind an ability to step back from the gambling industry. Mm-hmm. Problem is, unless you enforce and police that area and protect it also, you'll find that community is looking for opportunities to gamble, and they'll find those with illegal websites. So we call those vulnerability vacuums, that basically there are children in those, and there's another one that has self-excluded players. So those self-excluded players are aggressively targeted by illegal gambling websites, and so are children, things like loot boxes and that kind of stuff. So what we found is that there's a audiences there that this, in the UK, before YieldSecker turned up, we had this kind of push-me-pull-you relationship between, is there any black market? Why would they be present? There's so many different options for consumers. There's nothing but consumer choice and fairness. They are there, but they're making their money from those communities where they basically don't need to compete with anybody else. There isn't anybody from the legal sphere who's targeting kids. There's nobody from the legal sphere who's targeting self-excluded customers. There are only illegal sites there.
Yeah. And how, so how, because obviously the there's, you've got the gaming bodies like the BGC talking about the threat of offshore, you've got anti-gambling going, this has been blown out of proportion, it doesn't exist. As the person with the actual data, what are you saying?
It definitely exists, but it's going towards those communities where basically illegal industry understands one thing very well. Get as many customers as you can for as small an outlay as possible for the cost per acquisition. So your CPA cost needs to be extremely low for them to be interested, and they need to have as easy a route into that audience as possible. So with the self-excludes and the children, nobody else is present. So you're picking up customers in the double-digit CPA kind of values. You're looking at getting customers extremely cheaply, and you're not having to go out there and buy CPC terms or pay-per-click terms or anything like that. So you're basically saying, I don't need to spend any money here. I need a well-optimized, SEO-optimized website, and I need some decent presence on social media and on Discord and user groups like that. So as long as I go for those things, I know I can get a line of sight to my audience, and that will acquire them extremely cheaply.
So is it 1%, 2%, 10%? What
we found with our World Cup monitoring was that the UK has, in volume terms, 1.5% of the UK is basically illegal industry that's there. So of all the revenue that's going to the UK, now that might sound small, but that's one of the world's biggest gambling marketplaces online. So you need to look at it in that context. The other piece is, in terms of that at-risk, vulnerable audience, the children and the self-excludes, 100% of that business is going through illegal sites. So they control that revenue route completely. There'll be some overlap where they're featuring advertising and stuff, but basically it needs to come down to, you need to be monitoring, policing, and enforcing a marketplace once you've declared it. You can't just expect that we've legalized this and therefore all the business will now go to legal sources. You can't have an attitude that most regulators are under pressure, politically particularly, that once legalization has been done, they can announce within 3 months, channelization is perfect, it's 85, 95, 99%. It doesn't work that way. You need to have the kind of enforcement, and you need to make sure that on an ongoing basis, and that's why YieldSec was established to be this constant monitoring tool, you need to be able to see where the audience is, what the audience is interacting with, what's converting from that interaction, and where it's going to. And what you'll find is in any marketplace that we turn on the YieldSec system, it's a mixture of legal and illegal sources all the time.
Yeah. So obviously the UK is one example, and I think it's something I've talking a lot about over the years is the likes of, say, Sweden and Germany as well, where it's a regulated market. During COVID, Sweden introduced a lot of legislation to protect people during lockdown, but it actually just fueled an offshore boom. And then Germany had its, you know, regulation nightmare of just killing the products and created a massive offshore. Have you looked at either of those markets by any chance?
Looked at both of those markets, actually. So look, it's an interesting one, because what you can see in any of these marketplaces is there's a pressure that comes from just without monitoring the system day to day. And again, government clients are harder to get. It takes longer to get government contracts, et cetera, just because of the process with any government procurement. When you start looking at the nature of what's going on, there is, without knowledge of the marketplace, you're constantly not going to really know how much money there is in the business in your jurisdiction. Mm. The other part of this is how many audience members are participating with this, and who are those audience members in terms of not you as an individual, but who you are as an audience type in demographic terms. Are you underage, overage? Are you an at-risk or vulnerable player? The other piece is... you're going to constantly, without that knowledge, you're going to constantly create pressure politically for more and different legislation. So if you don't feel that you have something under control and you don't know how to check if you have it under control, there's a constant feeling of maybe we need more protection for underage players. Maybe we need more protection for the younger audience. Maybe we need a two-stage system. Some of the things that the UK has just announced recently to have a two-stage staking relationship with slot machines, for example. How on earth would you bring in that two-tier system of slot machine stakes without knowing what age people are, without knowing what's available in the marketplace? So in Sweden and Germany, you've got this issue of there is an overkill on the do-good attitude, let's try and change things, let's try and control the gambling machine, but you don't understand the dynamics also of how that's going to interplay once it hits the market. So you try putting on things like, okay, we're going to have a, Germany, for example, has a 10-second spin delay on slot machines. You introduce a piece of regulation like that and say that for every slot machine play, when you press the spin button, there will be a 10-second delay and then the machine will spin. On the basis that their view is, from the research they've done, a delay will discourage gambling addiction with slot machines. We found from how we're monitoring things is what that delay introduced was basically the entire audience en masse picking up some disinformation and some kind of fake stories online that said that spin delay was the machine being rigged. So it's rigged play. All of the legal support. So somebody started that story on a Discord group. The Discord group jumped to some open forums, and then that metastasized into this good piece of regulation that was introduced. Whether it's good or bad is up to the marketplace to assess. This do-gooding piece of regulation that came in, it had the right intentions, okay? Had all the hallmarks of we're going to try to do something good here to discourage gambling addiction. What that did was make people look specifically for certain sites who were saying, well, we don't have a 10-second spin delay. Who are those sites? They're all the unlicensed illegal ones. So they picked up, it's almost within a week, it was frightening to look at the dynamics from our perspective of seeing the kind of peaks and troughs with just looking at slot machine play. You're able to see a jump to the kind of searches for kind of, you know, slot machines without a 10-second spin delay, no 10-second spin delay, no spin delay slots. So people start looking for this stuff themselves. And the other problem you have nowadays is that most search is driven by voice. So search goes through the roof in terms of the amount of variety of kind of search phrases that are used. And for us to be able to kind of collate that down to, they're all looking for that non-10-second spin delay stuff. That's what they're looking for. So it shows, it's one extreme example of kind of like, look how badly it can backfire if you don't explain to the audience why you're doing it. And also if you feel like as a regulator or a government, you have control over the gambling machine, but maybe use something like YieldSec to check the dynamics as to how that's going to kind of work out, how it's going to manifest once it hits an audience. And that's an audience that are very open to things like, well, I read it on some user group. It must be true. Of course, somebody's doing that. Of course, they're rigging it. They want to make more money from us.
Well, look, everyone's, you know, if you've had a bad run, you're convinced it's rape. So that makes a lot of sense. So, okay. So, and I think what also makes sense is because you're not the operator, you're not a anti-gambling lobby group, which are kind of the two strongest voices. You're not a land-based operator either, or on, you know, so these are kind of the loudest voices in the room. Typically, it's just like, look, guys, here's the data. This is what the data says. So you're in that lovely kind of neutral space of, look, the data says this, and this is how it's trending.
Fintan, that's a great point. Again, we set ourselves up as I obviously have been in operations for a long time. I don't have any interest in operations. I hold no shares in any gaming company, and nobody who works for us can have any either. So we have a view that basically you have to set something up as the single source of truth and something that's independent and neutral. So I won't be made into anybody's kind of beast of burden on this stuff. It's like you mentioned earlier, the BGC. So the BGC did some work with us, and I was accused straight afterwards of being the BGC's propaganda mouthpiece. I don't even work with the BGC on an ongoing basis. And the view is just that I did some work for them. I did some work for lots of people in the UK at that time across the World Cup. A number of people joined a pilot project we had because we'd only recently launched them. But it's the view that I'll work for any legal stakeholder, whether it's law enforcement, government treasury, the regulator, operators who have a license, suppliers who have a license, the NHS, for example, have approached us. So I'd be open to working for anybody so long as you are a legal stakeholder. You have skin in that game then, basically. I'm not selling any data to illegal sites, basically. And that's done on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. So if I'm going to offer you UK data, you have to have a UK license, effectively, if you're an operator.
Two small things. One, I have, while we've been talking, solved the issue of money laundering in the gambling industry.
Nice. Good grass.
Sure.
Well, the key is the money part of it. Basically, if you haven't got any, it's not a big problem.
Okay.
Deep.
I don't ever worry about money laundering because I haven't got any. If some suddenly appeared in my account, I'd be like, oh, Jesus. Even the bank would flag money in my account. Even the bank would be like, strange activity on your account. It's in credit, motherfucker.
There's money coming in.
The text message would actually say, motherfucker. God bless you, Barclays. Unless you're going to like research some institution from top to bottom, the blue tick, if you like, of working with somebody is, have you got a license to practice? If you have, you're probably sane. Obviously, we're not talking about the BGC in that sentence, but YieldSec, obviously, you're doing great and business is really, really good. Have you ever considered sponsoring a podcast?
I'd love to at some point, because I think there are issues that come out of what we generate in information terms, that there's part of the information I need to sell specifically to, here's an operator, let's talk about what they're doing in the United Kingdom. So at one level, there's a base level of what's the channelization number? Is it 80% legal, 20% illegal? Everybody needs to know that kind of fact. At the other level, what we're able to do is show, let's take an operator, like I started my career in gaming working for Ladbrokes. So I'm able to look at all of the stuff that channels in to Ladbrokes and all of the stuff that channels away from Ladbrokes as well. So I'm able to sell Ladbrokes as an operator their data in terms of how are you optimizing yourself and are you protecting yourself against illegal operators? Because a lot of business that illegal operators get will be off the back of not just spoofing, I'm making myself look like Ladbrokes, but they'll be taking their odds. They'll be taking their data feeds. They'll be taking a lot of their content too and a lot of their promotions and offers and trying to make themselves look better than Ladbrokes. So a lot of it is a case of you have a direct bunch of links, affiliate links, influencer links, and your content is featured cheek by jowl with a bunch of illegal operator content. Did you even know that was going on? A lot of the stuff that's featured for you by affiliates that you might work with, if you don't police and control those affiliate relationships, where is your content being used? What's it being pushed towards? So we find multiple instances of people have affiliate relationships with a bunch of affiliate sites, and they find that basically the affiliate is just using them to salt the beef almost to basically say we've got some that happens particularly in marketplaces like Germany, for example. So a lot of the affiliates or all the affiliates that we have in Germany, I think the stats we pulled recently, so we've just done some German reporting. In Germany, of all the affiliates there are, and there are a huge number, most of them are pushing a mixture of legal and illegal websites on those lists kind of thing. And they're doing that partly to not get in trouble with the regulator and also because there's no real control of affiliates, so they just want to make as much money as they can. So we actually have a name for them called double dip affiliates, where they're basically quite happy to push illegals and legals as well. So they're very
In defense of the German affiliates, there was a weird or is a weird situation where technically, if the operator has applied for a license, you're allowed to promote them, so they won't appear on the whitelist.
But I
know what you mean. I'm not trying to whitewash it out, but there's definitely there's a little bit of nuance there on that as well. As an affiliate, you've got no way to verify that. You've just got to take the affiliate manager's word that we've applied for the license and we're abiding by the terms. Oh, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, so we don't get to apply for the license, but let's take a more extreme. So Germany's one example where we don't get to know who's applied for the license, but we're constantly updating as soon as it appears on the new list.
Yeah, sure.
And we also check to make sure that have you applied for a license or not. Switzerland is a more extreme example. So in Switzerland, you can only have licensing for local sites. You have to have a brick and mortar license to maybe be able to jump into online for casino, for example. Mm-hmm. So in Switzerland, what we found was some affiliates were being told off during the pandemic by the regulator. And they were told, you're not allowed to feature these sites because these sites don't have licensing. And that was pretty much the entire online industry from outside of Switzerland, basically was pushing into Switzerland. What they started doing in Switzerland, affiliates, was basically featuring between the hours of 8 a.m. and 4 p.m., they would feature legal-only sites. And after 4 p.m., when the regulator had gone home, they'd feature the illegal sites. So Switzerland was one of these examples of, there's no why they're doing this, and they're doing this on this clock. But they were doing it on the clock to basically go, the regulator's not in the office and nobody checks after those hours.
I've heard not Switzerland, but I have heard examples of finding the IP address or the region for wherever the office is, and then geo detecting that as well and showing them something else versus.
We've seen those examples too, where basically it's pushing things like abdominal exercise machines to that office. It's nothing to do with gambling. Don't keep looking over here. So it's almost like these kind of weak Jedi mind tricks that people are pulling to go, let's work around the regulator. And on the one hand, it's very funny to have a conversation about that on calls like this. But on the other hand, it's like, okay, where is that money going? Because ultimately, we all went as a species through the pandemic. We all know that created recession-likely economies. And I'm not saying that gambling taxation can solve all of those things, but gambling was the one thing for governments that it was able to always tap and say, we can get income from that, and we can get income lucratively and very quickly. And we're at a situation now where it's very hard to control that machine, and it comes with all of the other baggage around, should people be gambling? Is it kids? Is it this? Isn't it a bad and evil industry? I don't think gambling is a bad and evil industry. I think when gambling is run correctly, it has the ability to produce a river of good for society. It just needs to be focused on our community and our commerce onshore. And if we can get that piece right, I'd like YieldSec to be a part of providing that change.
That makes perfect sense. I wanted to talk about info. So obviously, okay, so if we kind of think of the journey we've been on, so you go out and get the data, analyze the data, structure the data, identify it, make sense, present it to your client, be it a government body, a regulator, or whoever it is. And then there's kind of the next bit. So they've got it. They're looking at it going, yes, this is clearly bad. Something must be done. What does enforcement look like?
So enforcement again, just to step back from that slightly, there is a piece here where I didn't want to make this 200-page reports every 30 days and nobody can make any sense of them. They don't know what to do with them. So this is very much targeted on whoever you are as a legal stakeholder client of YieldSec. It's very much directed towards actions and recommendations. So these are the things that you have to do. These are the things that you could do. And these are the things that might be nice to do. And the other thing that comes up through this is there are opportunities commercially for brands where they didn't realize that, oh, if I did that, I'd be able to get to more of my audience. More of my audience, this is where my audience goes. Once they've been to my website, they dumped out, and then they went to this operator. So there's a bunch of stuff there between legal versus legal. How do I get myself into a better position as an operator? So that's also a lot of the stuff we sell the brands directly. The other piece here in actions and recommendations is the action side of it. You need to coordinate with Facebook, with Google, with the police to go after these things. And I think the key kind of line we drew here is the money and the harm to players. So the money being taken is basically not just leakage. It's not just loss from the system. This is theft. Now, I looked at that in terms of my academic background in law, and I said, we tend to focus always on mentioning gaming law here. But gaming law only applies to those sites that have licenses. Gaming law, the whole system, is about a licensing structure. It basically means I can apply for a license, I can hold a license, I could lose a license. All of that stuff is a branch of administrative law and is there to make sure that the machine works correctly according to how the government in that country wants it done. When it's outsiders who are coming in and they're invading that marketplace and they're taking revenue and they're harming customers, what is that called? Now, I looked at that and just went, isn't this plain straight up theft? This is just criminal law because these people don't apply through gaming law because they didn't apply for a license, can't apply for a license. Surely they come under that aegis of theft. So I went back to Oxford, did a bunch of work there, and I kind of got to the point where I was convincing tutors there that this has to be theft, doesn't it? And everybody was agreeing that it must be theft because you could created a contained commercial marketplace. Anybody else coming into that now, it is theft. So once you bring it into that room of criminal law, it's now much easier for enforcement to start to bite because Facebook and Google don't want to have anything to do with content that could make them an accessory to theft. The police find it much easier to go after illegal websites because, okay, it's not just were they there, did they do this? If your system of monitoring means that I can capture all of those screenshots, I can show that they were definitely there, I can prove probable cause. Now it's a case of this is just straight up criminal law. It's theft, and there's 200 years plus of precedent in any jurisdiction that shows how to prosecute a case like that. So how does enforcement look? It's basically a much easier process on the basis of it's the breach of criminal law. It's not the breach of gaming law anymore. So once we brought it into that criminal law area, all of that stuff started to become a lot easier. So we have discussions with Europol, we have discussions in America with the state police, with the FBI, to go through, this is how you would enforce against them. And it starts to introduce teeth and an ability to go after them for asset forfeiture, etc., and get people to move. My aim here was not to destroy the illegal industry in any jurisdiction. My aim here was to basically go, this thing needs to work for all of us as a community. So what I'm trying to create is that run on the bank scenario where you went after, a government would go after one particular flagrant illegal operator, and you encourage all other illegal operators to go, let's get in line, let's try and put our house in order here. Let's maybe go for applying for a license.
So look, I'm not a, like, everything I know about law, I've learned from Law and Order and the Bill. So bear with me on this. So I'm going to extrapolate here. So there's we can prosecute these guys on criminal stuff. This makes sense. There's a precedent. There's all the infrastructures there for that. And then a district attorney or an investigator or a federal agent or whoever sits there and looks at it and then looks at all of the other crime they need to deal with, like the fentanyl crisis or domestic terrorism or whatever else. Is there actually any chance, unless it's the most flagrant, you know, on the cover of Forbes, come catch me type situations, where they'd actually bother?
I think that that's a very good point, Fintan. And again, if you look at this in terms of public policy, the amount of money that comes in from the gaming business legally is huge. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you then start to feel like 5, 10, 15, 20, 25%, and what we see in most marketplaces we're looking at outside of the UK, most marketplaces, whatever there has been said about channelization, you're looking at 40 to 50% of that marketplace is actually illegal revenue. So about half of the tens of billions of euros or dollars a year that are coming in is basically being taken away. So that's a harm to your onshore industry. It's a harm to the creation of jobs in that onshore industry. It's a harm to all of the linkage with associates and suppliers who supply you traffic for that industry. And it's a harm to your ability to actually factor for, I want predictability in my ability to manage. I'm going to spend X amount on roads and schools, etc. From the point of view of any other crises that are going on, if the governments say they have something under control and the law is saying they have something under control, it's incumbent upon them to just to act here. Now, I'm not saying they want to then set up task forces and go after every single illegal online gambling company. They won't. They will go after that head of the snake, however. So that one kind of extreme example of, you are taking money away from us, you're taking money away from our sports sponsorships, you're taking money away from our media and our society generally, we have to make an example of you. There is always a company like that or a group of companies that are doing that in any marketplace on earth. So no matter how small the marketplace, you can even look at a market like Finland or Norway or Sweden, not particularly massive in terms of population, they're not particularly massive in terms of money, but it's a big enough issue that they have to get control on, because they don't have necessarily things like that fentanyl crisis competing in those marketplaces. In the United States, there's a lot more competitiveness among the district attorneys. What do I need to put on the board as these are crimes I've solved, crimes I'm dealing with? You've got gun crisis, fentanyl crisis, so many different issues in any American community. But this is one of those things where if we don't get this one under control, you will never see online gaming move from just online sports betting legalization into multi-product legalization. If we can't control one, how do we control many?
Sure, that makes sense. Because like, you know, there's been plenty of examples where, like, I'm in Amsterdam, so there's plenty of examples where there's a big headline fine has been issued by the Dutch authorities.
Yeah.
And you know for a fact that letter, wherever it arrives, where it's sent out, just goes straight in the bin, right?
Yeah, that letter ended up being sent to a boat in Antigua somewhere. That was the end of it.
Good luck with that, right? And like, or if you look at Australia, Australia is a good example. So Australia is very active with IP blocking. So it'll, right, we've identified these 100 illegal online casinos and we've blocked them all at an ISP level. Within minutes, redirects are in place and all of those online casinos are live again in another domain name.
Yeah,
And so there's loads of examples of where enforcement's tried to happen, but the nature of the internet is that it's resilient. It's designed to be resilient. It was designed to withstand nuclear war, right? That was the whole point of it. It's like the game of whack-a-mole, it makes it really hard for anybody to properly enforce.
So look, that was one of the, as good you use that phrase, whack-a-mole. So look, whack-a-mole for me, and just to be clear for anyone listening, the game of whack-a-mole is the one with the hammers and the little moles that pop up. Children love playing it because these moles pop up. As soon as you hit them, another one pops up somewhere else. So
it's a great way to get stress relief. But it's not a kid's game. That is like, if you've had a bad day, a good game of whack-a-mole sorts you right out. Trust me.
There's definitely a Yield Sex sponsored version of whack-a-mole to come in the future.
There we go. Nailed it.
That's the go-to product I'd like to put my brand on. Absolutely. So with that in mind, I'd fondly played that with my daughter when she was growing up, and it kind of stuck in my head as there's something there that needs to be lined up. But whack-a-mole for me was that example of all of that stuff is not just that within a few minutes they'll be up and running with another site. They're up and they're prepared for that as a business as usual approach. So all of the illegals that we monitor in any jurisdiction, they basically, so across Latin America, for example, pre the World Cup, we started finding gambling related content on things like hospital websites, particularly children's cancer charity websites and this kind of stuff. So we were finding mirrors of a bunch of content for gaming sites was being parked, and it was on the background of a website that would be for children's cancers. Why is it there? What is that, a mistake? Is that just somebody who's a kind of gambling site fan who's put that content there? No. This was a specific strategy that if their main domain got taken out, they wanted the exact same content with every third word changed, because then it would get tagged by Google as a kind of replicated content that's trying to improve SEO and search engine positions. That content was already featured and it was live in various places. getting the benefit of relevance and authority that it was live somewhere, but it wasn't going to any particular source until the point of that website being seized or that website being blocked happened. Then that content would come in and start feeding another website altogether. But they feature the content online to get the benefit of the relevance and authority. So they don't need to go from position 500 million on Google. They want to get to that first page on Google kind of thing. So they already have that content live and they're seeding it in various places. So we found a bunch of hospital websites and we were kind of having to tell them, did you know your website's been hacked? Did you know you have all this content? And they were like, we had no idea this stuff was there. So we find that regularly. It's a business as usual kind of strategy to have behind any one website, you'll have an average of 3,000 mirrors and clones behind it. So at any point, if the one website, illegalsportsbets.com is taken down, there'll be illegalsportsbet1.com, illegalsportsbets2.com, illegalsportsbets3.com. All of that stuff is already ready and either operating already or it's ready to go. The other piece that comes in there is that you have things like the Asian stuff where it's basically advertising on perimeter boards during the Premier League. So quite often you'll see these kind of Chinese characters and numbers URLs come up during perimeter board ads. Yeah. Those are basically telling you this week's URL is because their last week's one already got banned. So they're just updating you in real time to say during the match, quite often those URLs will change as well. So they know that if they lose a URL during the match, this is the new one. So that was a soft way of being able to inform the audience that's this current URL. The other way was text messaging. And again, the text messaging stuff is stuff that we find. So we're constantly finding stuff that's basically made public because the audience are posting it on Twitter. They're posting it on their Telegraph pages. So we're finding stuff that the audience tell us how that thing replicates. But the machine is constantly moving from a point of view of constantly communicate to the audience, this is the URL to go to this week. These are the sites you can play at now. And the other one that's been massive here is if you look at India, for example, India's got a whole culture of kind of, they will open the account for you. You'll find advertising on a bunch of ripped off Bollywood movies being played online. During those movies, it's constantly featuring URLs to tell you that go to this URL or here's our WhatsApp number, go to the WhatsApp user group. The WhatsApp user group will open the account for you, issue you with the username and password in real time, and they've got offices doing this stuff for you kind of thing.
I heard of one group, and they were gambling operator who were pirating the movies so they could embed like really high quality stuff so they could embed the advertising and then see.
We just had saw this weekend. So I was just looking at this with the team yesterday. We were looking at Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. That has 1xBet featured throughout the movie. So that is an almost perfect copy. There's some issues with the sound file on it from the one that's gone up now. So there's basically 1xBet is embedded throughout the movie. Every 7 minutes on average, you get a 1xBet pop-up. They're all in Hindi is the other thing. I didn't know that Guardians of the Galaxy was so popular, but all of the ads were in Hindi. All of the ads would fail any of the ad regulations in any European market because they're all things like a guy trying to get into a nightclub, and because he's got 1xBet on his phone, he gets into the nightclub and all the women love him. It's amazing.
Only it was that easy.
And also, he leaves on a motorcycle. He looks like Rambo. It looks like Cobra when he leaves kind of thing. It's hilarious kind of thing. That they've got these weird ways of advertising, but it shows you that 1xBet will basically put hair on your chest and make you popular with women, apparently. So
good to know. Good to know.
Loving the Cobra reference there, my God.
I had to do a double take there just because Rambo obviously wasn't great. It was Cobra. Yeah, that movie's underrated.
I mean, it's one of Stallone's worst.
absolutely.
But it is hilarious. It was directed by a guy called George P. Cosmatos. And the other thing that Cosmatos is...
movies, actually. His son does interesting movies. He did a great one with Nicolas Cage recently called Mandy. So,
hang on, who does?
George Cosmatos' son.
Oh, okay. Well, Cosmatos was best known for lots of episodes of The A-Team.
Yeah, it's very true.
You can actually see is similar touches in Cobra, like the shot with the camera is down on the hubcap of the car in a car chase. It's very much a Cosmatos signature shot.
Interesting. Glad to know that.
Weird to speak to somebody who's heard of George P. Cosmatos. Never mind Detective Cabretti. Such a bad movie. So bad. But the Spectrum 48K game was excellent, I've got to say.
I don't remember that one, I'm afraid.
It was a platform shooter, but the animation was particularly advanced.
I remember that game, the Cobra game. I was too young for the movie, but I played the game. My friend had it.
Well, I think myself and Ishmael were also too young for the movie. It's hard to tell, though, because only one person in this call has hair.
That's very true. I could never place you on hair. You have a great head of hair there, Fintan.
Thank you, Brett. It's amazing what they can do with implants these days. It's, I'm a spokesmodel now at this point.
Very good.
Okay, brilliant. So basically, you can identify an overall marketplace. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. This is the estimates for channelization. Monitor it in effectively real time. Actionable insights, actionable data for operators, regulators, governments, law enforcement.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. It's really great.
So, well, I'm glad we've solved something again.
One final question, and then I'll leave you alone. I always love the hero's journey. So I'm a big fan of entrepreneurs, and I'm a big fan of people who go out and create their own business and do their thing. What was your kind of moment of, oh, I need to do that? How did this come about? What was the...
Is this for me or Ishmael?
Definitely for Ishmael. I know how the podcast came about, John. I was there.
You lads carry on.
Thank you very much. That's a great question. I got to a point where I'll turn 50 at the end of this year, okay? So I wasn't bothered by that a few years ago, but I got to a point where I'd done a bunch of operational roles and I'd been successful in those. I'd taken PokerStars, the number one, Paradise Poker, Sporting Bet. Was it another marketing mission and another COO operational mission for me? And I got to a point of thinking, I've done what I can do in the operational side of this business. And where I started my career was with 2 law degrees from Oxford, and then I went into investment banking and then jumped into online gaming, just by accident almost. Tying up those 2 threads, that I had a real understanding of the law and a real understanding of I wanted to do some stuff that made society fairer and made a difference to people's lives, and then this deep and detailed experience in iGaming. If there was something that would unite those 2 threads, would have been interesting for me. And when I came across this example after example as a consultant of working for a brand in Germany, they're facing impending regulation, everything is doom and gloom and the industry's over kind of thing, and they're going to lose money and the staff are in no position to understand where their future lies. Going to Latin America and working for brands there, you understand that they are so impinged upon and overlapped by illegal operators that they can't make money and therefore there is no taxation future. Going to work for brands in Africa, same thing. If they don't have a legal contained system, there is no hope of raising taxation from gambling. And those societies really need that money. Pre-pandemic, this was that kind of like, what are we doing here? We need taxation from something, and we need taxation where we can turn on that spigot as much as we need it and then let it go back to normal again. You have no ability to do that unless you can control the industry. And then looking at the UK, where we've got this extremely polarized debate between anti-gambling and pro-gambling, and it's kind of like, if this thing works because it's run properly, everybody gets what they need from the gambling business, and there is no harm that's being caused that can't be paid for, can't be kind of researched away, can't be kind of massaged and managed properly. So I looked at both of those things and went, there is nothing here. We have a completely scorched earth of there's no real reliable figures that show us what's really going on. And I'd gone around everybody who said that they had anything to do with the black market and I'd spoken to them and understood their business model and stuff and got to a point where I understood they're just bullshitting these guys. They're going around telling everybody they know what the black market is, but they're not pointing to anything real online in terms of that's where the audience is, that's where the sites are, that's where the business is moving to. Now, I'm not saying I can dollar for dollar definitely value an illegal online gambling company, but I've done everything that's based on facts to be as close as damn it to what that number is. And I know that sure. Basically this is what a legal site produces. This is what an illegal site produces because they're all using the same traffic numbers, all using the same data across their websites. And nobody can hide that from me because you'll never know that YieldSec was looking at you. Again, we'll be as close to you as your jugular, but you won't know that we were there. There's nothing that says this was a YieldSec kind of website coming in and looking at a YieldSec spider coming in and looking at your traffic or something. Nobody will ever know that. So I got to a point where I wanted to say, let's do something decent with all of that background and 2 degrees from Oxford and stuff. I was extremely privileged to go somewhere like that. Nobody in my family had been to university, so I saw it as I was lucky to end up with a mind like I had. I was lucky that I ended up with a really stubborn sense of mind as well, about I want to be able to get to things where I haven't just come up with something, I've come up with something that is a solution. And I'll work on that being the best solution there is, regardless of whoever comes into the space to compete with it. I wanted to get to that. So what we set up with YieldSec was very much driven by, very much driven by me wanting to get to a point where this thing was solved. This thing is solved for the future. And as more people come into it and start looking at it, we've at least established the resting heart rate of that's what this marketplace works like. That's how this industry operates. And if you're going to introduce changes to it, this industry has an ability to provide unalloyed good if it's run correctly. From now on, stop seeing it as a bad thing. Start seeing it as a thing you need to tolerate and a thing that actually can pay for a bunch of stuff in society generally, as long as you understand it's legal versus illegal. Getting rid of the crime is the most important thing.
Love it. Love it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Very welcome.
Yes, what Fenton said.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for today.
Really appreciate it.
Great. One closing question, and it's partly because of your age and it being relevant to your age. Do you have a favorite Kevin Costner film?
Favorite Kevin Costner film? Kevin Costner's an interesting one. I was actually reading about him the other day because he's having all these issues with his Yellowstone series right now and arguing with people. I'd probably say Dances with Wolves. You should ask me that question again with Michael Douglas, to be honest. I'd say favorite Michael Douglas film. Why did you ask me about Kevin Costner exactly?
It's just a straw poll we're conducting. Fenton's is The Bodyguard, predictably.
My Dances with Wolves. And if it was Michael Douglas as the question, I would say Black Rain.
John looks stunned and horrified.
What? I think that's a great really,
people who can't see the video.
I think you've just got a thing about a particular style of sunglasses.
I have.
I think you'll find that Cobra and Black Rain on the publicity, both actors wearing the same sunglasses.
You're very correct in that as well. I definitely have a thing about the sunglasses. In both movies, the sunglasses were in the poster for as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally no. Black Rain's pretty awful. I thought you might come from left field with Michael Douglas, and of course with Michael Douglas, the beauty of Michael Douglas is that you can throw in movies he's produced, and he's produced some fabulous films.
That's true.
But like the Beyond the Candelabra, the Liberace movie,
Behind the Candelabra. That's a great one. That's a great movie.
And I'm not a fan of his, but he was absolutely unbelievable in it.
Nobody's
mentioned Falling Down as a Michael Douglas movie.
Oh, that's a great movie. I love that film.
Now, you see, I dispute that because I don't think it's a great movie. I think it hits all of the major notes. I think there's nothing to it. It's a completely one note film, and Joel Schumacher, which is why it's a completely one note film.
That's surprising for Schumacher to have done that, considering he did the worst Batman ever.
He did. He did a lot of worst evers, to be fair. And he hit his stride.
We're not mentioning
his stride
Wall Street? Michael Douglas's Wall Street?
Wonder Boys was terrific. Wonder Boys was really, really good. But then Wonder Boys is based on a phenomenal book. And it translated really well.
So I'll have to check that one out.
I would say the first half of Wonder Boys is as good as anything he's done. And the first third of the book is as good as anything you'll read this year.
Great.
It's very, very fabulous indeed. But, God, Michael Douglas. My God. Black Rain, though. I was working in a video shop when Black Rain came out. And they had two copies of it. It was film number 1310 and 1311. And
that's priceless, honestly.
I still, it might have been 1310 and 1311 and 1312, to be fair. But I still recognize people by their membership numbers now. I mean, that's 1254. It's only been 30 years.
Jesus, John. You want to get that checked?
It's really bad.
That's not good for you.
Video rental was an amazing time. I love that whole culture and stuff. And I just, weirdly enough, I grew up in TV and video shops, and we sold the hardware kind of thing. But so we had a video rental place right next door to us, and that was it was fascinating to see the kind of. I remember when the pirate copy of E.T. came out. I've never seen people pay money like that to see a movie, because in those days they had the big window between. It was like a came out in whatever year it was, but it wasn't going to come out in the UK in the cinemas for at least another 2 years, kind of thing. So we had these massive windows between premieres. So everyone was renting that film pirate. So.
I was listening to a podcast by a guy called Charles Band, who's an independent film producer and director. And he's done some real trash in his life. He's done some really good stuff as well, but not much of it. But he's had a fascinating career. And one of the cool things that he did was he set up one of the first businesses to license and sell video cassettes in the US.
Yeah.
And the really interesting episodes of his podcast are when he's talking to people like Roger Corman, even John Landis, people that worked for Corman, and talks about the whole process. And these stories just come spilling out. And he talks about, you know, licensing Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And you know, it's like, it's incredible. And we forget that once upon a time, home entertainment was not just fledgling. It was the Wild West.
Exactly.
And, you know, somebody setting up a streaming site now, even to set up a streaming site, you need colossal resources. It ain't the same thing.
No, not at all.
It's very different.
Just to touch on that quickly, the next area we're obviously going into is we believe that the YieldSec platform works in more than just one vertical. So we started in gaming, obviously. Streaming is one of our next ones, and crypto after that as well. So it's the exact same model that you have legal and illegal places that you can get content. And we are looking hard at the YieldSec version for streaming and a YieldSec version for the crypto markets, particularly now that the European Union's obviously regulating cryptocurrency exchanges and platforms. So it's not for us, it's not just a one note business. It's basically, it works in lots of different industry verticals.
You're going to be busy then.
I hope so. I intend to be.
As soon as you said the magic C word, I'm like, yeah, crypto. Good luck with that one. And people are always evangelizing. They're like, selling it are always evangelizing. You've got to do it.
They're all AI experts. All the crypto bros are AI experts now. It's all flipped.
Yeah.
It's amazing looking at my LinkedIn feed of the career change mid quarter.
Interesting. Everybody jumped into AI there. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was a terrible film. Ismail, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a
pleasure. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.